welcome to the Comics Canon, the podcast that reads, reviews, and renders judgment on the greatest comic book stories of yesterday and today. In this episode, we discuss Dangerous Habits, originally published in John Constantine Hellblazer, issues 41 through 46 by DC Comics. Join us as we ask the burning questions: how good is this story really? And does it belong in that body of great comic book works known as the Comics Canon? My name is Kevin Morrow.
And my name is Kurt Holman. And Kevin?
Yes, Kurt?
Happy Pod-niversary.
Well, thank you.
Yes. Our first episode was basically this weekend last year when we talked about Fantastic Four, The Coming of Galactus.
Right. That one dropped on January 20th. We did have a zero episode that It sort of explains the podcast that you could still listen to.
So it's basically we've been doing it for a year. So,
yes.
Yeah. Learned a few things, maybe.
Hopefully. Yeah. This one, you hearing it on or sometime after January 18th, mm-hmm. 2017.
So it's a little early, you know. Yeah. We might not be celebrating that much on January 20th. So, yeah. Anyway, but not going to get political, even though we're talking about John Constantine, who is pretty political himself.
Yes. Yeah. So we wanted to discuss Hellblazer originally because there was sort of a tangential tie-in to Justice League Dark, mm-hmm. the animated movie that is coming out digitally and then on Blu-ray, and the character of John Constantine, although a very different version from this one, is in Justice League Dark. However, there's not really a good Justice League Dark book.
Yeah. And we use that as kind of an entry point. And we had decided this when we heard that there was going to be an animated version of Constantine on the CW's Seed, I guess is the name of it. And with starring Matt Ryan voicing the character, he starred in the CW show. So it's like the character is like, has this currency going on. Yeah. It's like, well, let's do a Hellblazer storyline. And this kind of bubbled up as kind of maybe not the best one, maybe it is the best one, but was kind of the best known one. And kind of, if we're trying to think of one, this one came to our mind first, basically.
And partly, as we'll mention later, this storyline is loosely referenced in the Constantine film mm-hmm. from 2005 with Keanu Reeves. Mm-hmm. So maybe we should discuss the character a little bit before we jump into the book.
Yeah, the character originated in Alan Moore's Saga of the Swamp Thing. Alan Moore wrote him and his artists, and he co-created him, and was originally visually patterned a bit after Sting, right. Which is kind of it's kind of ironic because even though he looks kind of like Sting, he's his sensibility is a lot more attuned to like the straight up punk of England in the 1970s. And, you know, Sting at the time kind of diverged into his sort of tantric jazz rock era. So Constantine's sensibility and Sting's sensibility kind of went on different paths, you know. But
tantric jazz rock.
Yeah, but
if you've never listened to the music of Sting, that is the perfect descriptor.
And he is kind of a
not really.
He's an exorcist and a magic user, but was conceived as kind of a more streetwise, working class, you know, grounded magic user, and very sardonic and witty, and you know, doesn't take anything seriously, even though he's dealing with the biggest issues of life and death.
And a bit of a con man, too, and is always, like, playing angles and mm-hmm. playing people against each other with a real kind of, I almost said devil may care, no pun intended.
Yeah.
But not just sardonic, but cultivates this atmosphere that, you know, a bit aloof mm-hmm. and sarcastic, it kind of as a means of protection. And it's funny because in those original Swamp Thing stories, you know, he's manipulating Swamp Thing, Alec Holland, and trying to save the world, mm-hmm. I guess, which seems very unlike the characters we get to know him mm-hmm. here and in the Hellblazer series in general, you know, where he's, you know, like a kind of meddling magic user.
Well, he's very much an anti-hero and, you know, wants to like accomplish good and stop demons that are encroaching without kind of regard for the collateral damage that'll cause. So he's kind of a means justifies the end and feels like enormous guilt over, you know, when his friends or people who come to him end up getting, you know, hit in the crossfire, right. You know, but he's willing to like sacrifice other people, you know, to, yes, yes. in the name of the greater good.
Yeah. And we'll discuss that. But my point is that in his original appearance in Saga of the Swamp Thing, he's a bit more proactive, where in the books, you know, it's mostly he gets involved when he really has no other choice. But whatever.
Yeah. So we do hear the and he started in Swamp Thing, had his own title, Hellblazer, and with Jamie Delano as the writer there, and then
the first one, right?
Yeah. And this was the storyline was the introduction of Garth Ennis writing the character.
Yeah, so this is the start of Garth Ennis's run on the book, which I think is arguably the most well-known and well-regarded run on the series, which was later canceled and so that John Constantine room could be made for him in the mainstream DC universe, the New 52, back in 2011.
But he'd lasted for like 300 issues, which I remember kind of hearing about and not really registering at the time, because this was like, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, and how astounding to me that it lasted that long. And this character who I kind of think of as a sort of marginal figure in the DC universe actually has been around for, it's like he's not really that marginal if he's had 300 issues, a movie, and a show.
Right.
You know? So so should we do the creative team of this and then get into our summary?
So as we mentioned, the writer is Garth Ennis. Artist for this arc is Will Simpson. Inkers, we have Mark Pennington, Malcolm Jones III, Tom Sutton, Mark McKenna, Kim DeMolder, and Stan Walk, I guess. Colorist, Tom Ziuko. Letterer, Gaspar. And edited by Stuart Moore.
So it starts with issue 41, The Beginning of the End. John Constantine, English exorcist, ex-punk rocker, chain smoker, may have met his match when he's diagnosed with fatal lung cancer. When he's visiting a hospital ward for terminal cancer patients, he befriends an old man named Matt. After his doctor calls, waiting to further examine his demon blood, Constantine vows to find a way to beat death.
Issue 42, A Drop of the Hard Stuff. Constantine seeks help from an old friend, a fellow magician and hard drinker named Brendan. Brendan has discovered a spring of holy water beneath his home, and after turning some of it into beer, confides that he's dying as well. Satan appears at the door, revealing that Brendan sold his soul. Constantine tricks the devil into drinking the holy stout, sending him back to hell and allowing Brendan's soul to go to heaven.
Issue 43, Friends in High Places. A demon named Ellie tells Constantine that Satan, aka the first of the fallen, eagerly anticipates tormenting him in hell. With added motivation to survive, Constantine appeals to the Snob, a.k.a. the Angel Gabriel, who refuses to help, telling him he deserves to go to hell for his deeds. Out of options, Constantine hatches a desperate plan to save his life.
Issue 44, My Way. Constantine says goodbye to his sister Cheryl, his best mate Chaz, and his new friend Matt. After a silent send-off to the authority figures he's been fighting his whole life, Constantine holds up in an abandoned flat where he summons the other two lords of hell. Finally, he slits his wrist and the first appears, eager to observe his death.
Issue 45, The Sting. Do you see what they did there? Sting. The other lords of hell return, and we learn that John has sold his soul to both of them. Each having a claim, the three demons realize that if Constantine dies, they'll be forced to wage a war that none of them can win. Reluctantly, they remove John's cancer to keep him alive. The first vows to make Constantine pay for this humiliation.
Issue 46, Epilogue, Falling into Hell. After a celebratory bender, Constantine has a chance encounter with Brendan's ex-girlfriend, Kit. Remembering Matt, Constantine rushes to the hospital, just in time to see his friend one last time. Matt suffers a horrible death moments after Constantine's arrival. Kit comforts and anguishes Constantine, who is racked with survivor's guilt.
Okay, one of the things I wanted to say kind of off the bat is just... You know, the character had been around for a while. This was like issue 41. So he's well established as this, you know, chain smoking demon fighter with lots of attitude. And what a great premise this is for the character. I mean, it's like, I imagine, you know, Garth Ennis's forward pitch. He's got lung cancer and it's soul, you know, because, because you've got like this guy who fights supernatural things being struck by a completely natural, you know, problem. And smoking is one of his signature things. It was ironic. It's like the smoking is what's killing him. You know, it's like he's got it's like he's allergic to trench coats and is dying of that, you know. And thinking about it, you have a setting where you have an afterlife. So there is literally a heaven and a hell and maybe some other places. So how do you create stakes in a life and death thing? Well, what if you know you're dying, you know you're gonna go to hell, and the devil is super mad at you. So it's it kind of ramps up the damnation even more so. I was thinking about, like, there was an old Far Side cartoon with a line of people going into hell, and there's a demon standing at the door, and he's saying, it's like, okay, let's see, now will that be inferno or non-inferno? Ha ha ha, I'm just kidding. It's all inferno. Go on in, you know. So John Constantine's going into, like, super inferno, basically.
And not the X-Men event.
No, no.
There are a couple things I like about the premise and the fact that he, first of all, I like the fact that he, that Ennis starts his run with this. And of course, he had no idea how long he would be able to be on the book. So you might as well just start off with your best stuff.
Yeah.
But you can easily imagine another writer, you know, who, say, Jamie Delano decided to keep going. You could easily imagine somebody developing it as a subplot, you know, with the whole hoary cliche of John coughing into his, you know, handkerchief and seeing the spot of blood and then discreetly hiding it, you know, and then it takes over and becomes an A plot over time. Whereas, like, here, like, you don't need to work up to it because you don't have to, because as you said, it's such a well-established part of his character. As he tells, you know, the doctor, he's been smoking 20 or 30 cigarettes a day since he was a child. And
the doctor says, ah, well, there you are then, you know.
And what I really like about this arc is, you know, the supernatural, the first of the fallen is like the big bad here. And Hellblazer is nominally a horror comic. And, you know, you can be scared by the devil and supernatural things, but, like, what's worse than, you know, like, the body horror of cancer and the certainty of knowing you're going to die of this thing that you did and there's nothing you can do about it? You know, it really puts him in a great position right off the bat.
Yeah. One of the things, like, kind of in the early ones, they have some scenes, the, just talk about kind of the art for a bit, where there's this kind of monochromatic look, and the pencils seem kind of thin, and I'm not really crazy about that. It's kind of like, I can see where he's going, just like, here's some kind of like this sort of mundane conversations, you know, so it kind of makes it look kind of more serious. It also seems a little drab to me, and I don't feel like it adds as much as I kind of would want from it. So I kind of noticed that going through. That was kind of a note I had with this. You know?
Yeah, me too. And mine's probably voiced a little stronger than yours because you really only break out into like a full color palette twice. And one is after he's said his goodbyes and he's going outside, you know, he goes... I guess it's to Big Ben where he, you know, in Parliament where he gives his, you know, kind of silent speech, you know, I've always been fighting you, you know, whether it's politicians or just authority figures in general, you know, because, and you can read it subtextually and I'm not, you know, I'm not certain, but I would bet money that that was part of the reasoning for it is like, you know, he's got a new lease on life, oddly enough, because he's made peace with this ridiculous plan. He doesn't know if it's going to work or not, but he's in control or whatever, you know. He feels some control for the first time, and so his mood changes. Everything brightens a little bit. And then at the end, in the epilogue...
That's a nice observation.
Yeah. When he runs into Kit and they, you know, they reconnect, and obviously, you know... spoilers later on, they become a couple as Ennis's run progresses. But, you know, you could tell he's a little sweet on her and she's a nice tonic to everything he's been going through. And the color returns for that. And it's a nice effect, but I don't think it's worth the drabness of the colors the rest for the rest of the six issues. It's it is literally monotonous and it makes it a bit hard to get through at times. Just have a couple things I like about the first couple issues. There are some nods to, you know, the prior run on the book, past characters and adversaries and storylines. Nurgle, the demon whose blood is coursing through his veins. He had a twin that he didn't know about, things like that. But Ennis doesn't really lean on any of that. Like, he references it enough to satisfy people who, you know, coming over from the old run and may have liked those stories, but you don't need to know any of that stuff. It's just good coloring. Like, if you just pick this book up, you know, like, you don't get lost.
Yeah.
And, you know, I like that he establishes his own, you know, devil.
Yeah.
Rather than, you know, like Nurgle, who was, you know, an antagonist in the Delano stories, and I believe in the Newcastle arc, which is pretty famous.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't rely on any of that stuff. He brings in his own big bad, and it's Satan,
yeah.
The first of the fallen, yeah. You know, like who will come back in the run. I think that, you know, that's a good choice. I like that. I like the dream where he's confronted by the ghosts of some of his friends who have died as a result of his actions. And then he wakes up from the nightmare and immediately reaches for his smokes and lights up to calm himself down. That was a great touch.
I like the part, my favorite part of the dream actually was before the ghosts appear and he just thinking about, you know, having the mortician work on him and being in the coffin and being conscious of all that. He's just like, ugh, but that it kind of like gets through, you know, it sort of like has decently written kind of interior monologues, you know, that, you know, captures, I think, the voice of the character very well and kind of sort of hits. It's like he realizes he's sick. He sees the doctors. He meets Matt and, you know, it kind of just kind of hits the bases, you know, in an efficient way that doesn't really knock me out. But it's like it's kind of, OK, cool. We're establishing, you know, the stakes here and it's going along the way it needs to. One of my favorite parts in the book actually is how it has a framing device of him in this cafe for a long time kind of thinking. And you kind of see the owner of the cafe in the background. And then the guy comes to him and says, you know, you've been sitting here for 2 hours and you haven't touched your tea. And he comes in and says, you know, well, of course I'm not going to drink it. It's cold. And the guy says, well, it's of course cold because you haven't drunk it, you know. So it's a little almost vaudeville English music hall, you know, comedy, which fits the voice of the character and the run real well, I think.
And then just to be a jerk, to keep our clean rating, he's like, so no chance of a refill then? And gets kicked out. Mm. So the first couple of issues, the scene with Brendan, I think, in the second one is pretty well done. Mm. I like the contrast of the two aging magicians and one of them's dying of lung cancer and the other one's liver is about to go out.
Yeah, you know? and it's like... they're like talking a long time and they don't kind of, Constantine doesn't like say why he's really there. And then at the end, he kind of like basically asks, can you cure cancer? And he's like, I was going to ask you because I'm dying, you know? So there's a funny irony there. And, there's also just kind of a funny concept where, Brendan is a guy who's like kind of obsessed with alcohol and that having a drink with your friends is his idea of church. And he's got the greatest collection of spirits ever. And he's got, in this, like we say in the summary, this cave under his house where, I guess St. Patrick had blessed it. So is this spring full of holy water. And they use it to turn water, not into wine, but into beer.
Right.
And that's, you know, that's funny. You know, it's like, that's a clever thing. It also feels, you know, in keeping with the titles, kind of working class attitude, you know, and kind of the hard drinking, hard living, punk rock kind of ethos, you know. So it's like very nicely, you know, it comes together very well.
And Ennis, who is Irish, you know, I love, you know, the idea of having a drink with the devil.
Yeah.
You know, which to me feels like a very Irish thing.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess he can get a good way with it being Irish, you know. Yeah. And it feels like it's sort of winking at a stereotype in a sense of affection without kind of buying into it in a way that feels, you know, like a hostile or condescending stereotype.
Yeah. I will say in the second issue, when we meet the first, he doesn't seem all that imposing. Will Simpson, I don't know that he's a great character designer, you know, and we can talk about the art even a little bit more later, but he's not as imposing. It's unfair to compare him to Steve Dillon, who had become Ennis's longtime collaborator on this and Preacher. But when, you know, when Dillon is on the book for the rest of Ennis's run, basically, and the first shows up again, like he's this really physically imposing, you know, kind of swarthy, red-skinned, you know, sneering, you know, not like an obvious devil caricature, and also not just kind of, you know, here he's just sort of meant to look a little bit regal.
Yeah.
You know?
He seems, I mean, in this, he appears and he seems kind of more like quote-unquote death than quote-unquote the devil, which is okay. Yeah. You know, it kind of fits either way in this case. But I agree. And something about like the characters don't always look the same from book to book. Like the faces look slightly different sometimes. So there's a little minor inconsistency. I mean, some of that's just change of expression or angle or light, but it's still something where it's like, you know, it's interesting where some books it's like they look the same all the way through. And in this one, it's like there's some variations that seem kind of not right, you know?
Yeah.
But like I said, you know, as a, you know, self-contained Constantine story, it's like this, I feel like it has the sensibility and kind of the humorous, sardonic way very well, and kind of the getting the best of the devil way at the end, you know, works real well, and it also feeds into the rest, because it's like it gives the devil even more motivation to be angry at him, you know.
We meet Ellie very briefly, who will again play a part later as a series goes on, and I guess that's not really relevant to our discussion, which is just about this. And then we meet Gabriel.
And Ellie's a demon. Yeah. And so I was wondering if her name was like a nickname for like hell-y, you know. But and she just kind of says, you know, doesn't have help for him and says, oh, by the way, the devil's really mad at you. And you're really in for it. You know?
You think maybe the crypt keeper named her? Let's talk about the scene with Gabriel, which also is referenced in the movie with Tilda Swinton.
Yes.
Right? Yeah.
And I don't know if they identify him in the book as Gabriel. I just know that from looking at the Wikipedia page, but maybe I missed something. Because I just see him referred to as the snob here, and he's clearly an angel.
But I feel like he does say the name once, but
Maybe I missed it.
So spoiler alert, it is the angel Gabriel. Mm. And it's a nice scene, and I'm on the fence about how necessary it is. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what it adds except to show that Constantine has tried everything.
Yeah.
You know, like he's even swallowed his pride and gone to, you know, the quote unquote good guys, you know, has tried at least reaching out to someone connected to heaven and gotten the expected slap down there.
Yeah.
And it does, yes, on the other hand, play into sort of the class dynamic of the book, which again, when Constantine says a little silent prayer of defiance to authority and political figures and all of that. You know, very much, you know, he's a working class guy against, you know, the snobs of the world.
Yeah, I mean, he meets him at a place called the Cambridge Club, which is literally an old boys club, you know, where it's very privileged and, you know, wrapped in luxury, you know, and power brokers speaking softly to each other and stuff like that, you know. Yeah, it's, I'm of kind of two minds of it, because on one level, this is kind of exactly like I think Constantine would perceive like angelic authority, you know, so it's like you would think that his issues with authority would extend to heaven and angels and God, you know, just because anyone who's kind of in charge, he's going to have kind of a chip off his shoulder about, you know. So I'm kind of cool with that. Look at it from like the snob's point of view, because they throw him as a snob a lot. It's like, why would an angel act like this, present like this? Seems kind of odd to me, you know. It's like, why isn't he like serving food in a soup kitchen somewhere instead of hobnobbing with these rich swells, you know, these rich white English people, English men, you know. It's like, it seems, there's the whole kind of Christian, you know, it's easier for, you know, a camel to go through the eye of a needle than a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven, you know. So it seems like he's kind of on the wrong side here, but it seems like it fits, you know, Constantine's attitude towards that. So it fits his character perfectly, you know.
Yeah, there are a couple of notes about his interaction with Gabriel that are striking, and that's one of them. And the other one is when Constantine says, you owe me, and Gabriel says, you know, well, debt doesn't really carry a lot of weight with us, which also doesn't sound like a very Christian or angelic concept. Like, yeah, so what? Yeah. So you did me a favor. I don't owe you anything.
Yeah, it seems like the I might talk about this a little bit later, but the Neil Gaiman theology, cosmology, you'd think that the angels would be a little bit more willing to see shades of gray. Well, in this one, they're literally like black and white. And like the snob says, you know, you've ignored the Ten Commandments, you know. And the Constantine's like, the Ten Commandments? What are you talking about, you know?
I do also like that it reinforces the scene with Gabriel, the idea of the heaven and hell, as you mentioned, which is a lot easier, I think, to identify with and to know what the stakes are. Whereas in a lot of the previous run, you know, there's like, you know, he travels for a while with these kind of environmental activist hippie types, and there's cults and demons and stuff, and it's all kind of murky. And this is still pretty murky in different ways, but, you know, like, you've got the angels and the devils.
Yeah.
Like, I really like that kind of stark division. Not that there aren't shades in between, but, you know, like, they're both bad guys to him, too, which I think is a nice touch.
Yeah, I remember being a big fan of the original Hellblazer, you know, with Jamie Delano wrote. But it was kind of more like a Demon of the Week kind of, or Demon of the Month title, you know, and it's like, this time he's got this giant fly dealing with this old friend of his, you know, that he has to kill his old friend to stop, you know, kind of thing, you know. And I remember, even though, like, we're talking about this, you know, I remember enjoying those quite a bit, just no single issue or title, you know, bubbled up as much as, you know, Dangerous Habits did. But so, you know, the snob kicks him out, basically. And he kind of uses like a Jedi mind trick to get in the club, but, you know, ends up getting, you know, tossed out anyway.
Yeah. And so then, you know, he's sitting there drinking and trying to figure out what he's going to do and hatches on this plan that he doesn't quite reveal to the reader, and, you know, except as it's unfolding. Yeah. And then, you know, the gut punch, you know, in the sting. But he says his goodbyes, and the scene with Chaz, I think, is really nicely handled because, again, sorry to bring up previous issues, but he's treated Chaz pretty poorly throughout the title. Just kind of uses him when he needs him and, you know, doesn't really give a lot of thought or concern to Chaz's own situation. And it start, you know, this interaction starts out like that again, where Constantine's making fun of him for driving this, you know, super compact, like kind of a proto smart car, it looks like. And Chaz is explaining how he's in debt to this gangster and this is all he can afford and all these other things. And Constantine's sort of, you know, not being very sympathetic, let's say.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know what led up to it, but apparently, like, Constantine told him, gave him some advice, like maybe the world was ending, you know. Yeah. So he kind of made some decisions and then the world didn't end. So he ended up like in a bad position, you know.
Yeah. So. And, you know, their discussion doesn't go well. And Constantine leaves and he leaves a letter that says all the things that he can't say in person and gives him some money and apologizes for all the trouble that he's gotten him in and all that stuff. And that's a really nice touch, that, you know, for this guy who's so brazen and will just put himself out there and, you know, flip off the devil, but can't, like, look his friend in the face and say, I'm sorry, you know, like, just like he says goodbye to his sister, but he can't bear to say goodbye to his niece.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's really well done.
I mean, I should say that the name of this issue is My Way, which is kind of obviously the Sid Vicious My Way, I think, is thinking about in particular. Yeah. You know, so. Yeah, there's a part where he's like having kind of like a one last drink and like thinking about, you know, the people he's wronged or his friends. And he mentions Alec and Abby, which are basically Swamp Thing and his girlfriends. So it's kind of a nod to that. And the previous one he'd mentioned, someone mentioned the elemental, which is also Swamp Thing. So it's like kind of nice nods to that, you know. And he says it literally thinks that, you know, I did it my way, you know, when he's kind of done his, you know, final send off to authority and goes to kind of do the spells to summon the second of the fallen and the third of the fallen, basically. Yeah. So let's is not easy to say.
You know, So let's talk about the sting, unless you have anything.
No.
It's gruesome visually.
Yeah.
In a both a good way and a bad way.
Yeah.
Again, I'm not a big fan of the way Simpson draws demons, and it seems borrowed from the previous run on Hellblazer and a little bit from Sandman. And you have the one shapeshifter, the third, who, like, you know, is in one panel this really ugly misshapen thing, and then the next it's Elvis.
Yeah.
You know, stuff like that. But
and one's just like a blob of darkness, basically. And the other is, you know, Satan, the first of the fallen. And I wanted to say what I kind of my favorite artistic element of this is that he appears looking kind of like in Jesus. He's like wearing like a loincloth and is like kind of hanging in that kind of almost cruciform pose, which is very disturbing, you know, and it's like he's appearing like as an antichrist, and he's kind of mocking the idea in a way that there will be some salvation for him, and that he's not going to martyr himself, so he's going to look like the greatest martyr in a way. Mm-hmm. So it's an appropriately disturbing image in a book that maybe hasn't lived up to the capacity for disturbing images that we want.
You know? And it reminds me of Peter Stormare's introduction as the devil in the Constantine movie with the tarry feet and everything. Yeah. You know, like a really good visual representation. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that too.
And it's super blasphemous, of course. Yeah.
So on the one hand, like I'm not a big fan of Simpson's demons, but like the physical gruesomeness, and we can talk about Simpson's art a little more. I think it's effective here. Yeah. Like that gruesomeness, again, just like we talked sort of about the body horror of the cancer.
Yeah.
When he slits his wrist, for example, that's a lot more horrific to me than, you know, just kind of the black blob and the misshapen demon thing.
Well, we jumped over a part where he has a dream and his body is like turning into a giant tumor.
You know?
So that's kind of, I would say, an effective example of like the body harder example. So let's give credit where due to that. You know? But I agree. But some of the part of like kind of the morphing demons, it looks just kind of not that specific just because it's changing a lot. Yeah. You know, it seems like it's like he hasn't really has a strong idea of what's supposed to be conveyed here. Yeah. And it's helpful that the first, the second, and the third, all their word balloons are all different colors. So you kind of tell who's saying what, you know.
So what I really like about this issue is, and it's kind of an advantage and a disadvantage to the story as a whole as well. What I really like about it is we finally see what I think is the essence of the John Constantine character. He's a con man. He manipulates others. He's playing people against each other for his own ends. He's kind of anti-authority. He's always got a plan, even though, you know, he's not as in control as he's making it appear. Kind of on the razor's edge. And, you know, when things go bad, other people end up paying the price, which is kind of winked and nodded to with Matt in the in the epilogue, which is really just the final chapter. Epilogues and prologues are that's a discussion.
I have an opinion on that, but we'll go on.
Yeah, me too. This is like, as I said, this is like prototypical Constantine.
Yeah.
This is the ideal.
And this is his greatest trick, arguably. You know.
Yeah, but it's everything you like about the character. And the thing that is not so great about it is it takes this long for him to get here. Granted, okay, he's got cancer, but, you know, he hasn't been super compelling in the previous four issues. I mean, compelling, yes, in that you're like, oh, shoot, he's got cancer. What is he going to do? But like, I feel bad for saying that he comes off kind of whiny because, you know, he's got cancer, and I don't want to the extent that we're talking about a fictional character, I don't want to sound like I'm being glib or unsympathetic to that plight, you know, but narratively, it just feels like it takes a while for him to get his mojo back.
Yeah, I mean, I see, one thing is like when you have a character who is isolated and just kind of a loner and by himself a lot, like Constantine often is in this, that means that there might be lots of interior monologues like this has. And so he's kind of, and this, we've seen this in like in a lot of comic books that we've read, where it's like the character is kind of just sort of thinking and it's like kind of goes on and on and on and on, you know? So I think that might be kind of a side effect of that kind of approach. And he's, and he,
that's a really good point.
Yeah. And he is being, proactive up until now. And he's like doing kind of all the avenues he can think of. And then he comes up with kind of the most crazy, desperate avenue imaginable. Your plot of last resort, you know, and just to, you know, put a fine point on it, you know, the devil claims he has like a claim by right of insult, you know, so he deserves the soul because of what he did. And the other two want a soul because he separately sold his soul to them. So it's like they've all three got a claim ticket, you know, and they all can't, three can't have him, you know. So I just like, that's very clever, you know. Yeah. It's like you've got the premise of the book and the resolution of the book, and it's like this is one time where the resolution lives up to the premise, I think,
right.
You know. So it's kind of like going a different direction to what you were saying, but it's like I just kind of want to say how much I like how this turns out, you know. Yeah.
And to be clear, like in this issue, I really like the tension, and mm-hmm. even though he's done this and it gets to where it's going, mm-hmm. he has some doubt, mm-hmm. and as a reader, we could sit here and say, you know, it's gonna work because, mm-hmm. of course, he can't die because he's a hero of the book. Although, you know, it's a horror supernatural comic. He very well could die and become a dead detective. Yeah. You know? But there is tension as he's like, kind of like, come on, buy it, you know, waiting for them to come to the realization that it's the only thing they can do. Mm. And that does work really well.
Yeah. I mean, I like how in the unfolding of the narrative, when he kind of reveals his plan, how, you know, basically it comes to like, it could be that the devils could decide that they'll just share his soul. And it's like, okay, you have him, you know, Monday, Tuesday, yeah, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and we'll alternate every third Sunday, you know. But instead, you know, they can't compromise and they can't go to war with each other. So they end up like, the only way to win is to like have him keep living, you know. And it's funny. It reminded me of an old story that Matt Groening used to tell kind of in the in the 90s, when The Simpsons, you know, was like really big. Simpsons is still really big, but there was a talk about doing a live action spinoff about Krusty the Clown. And Groening was like particularly enamored of the idea of having, you know, a cartoon spinoff, a live action show, which I don't know if has ever been done, you know. But they couldn't make the negotiations work. And like there were different stakeholders who wouldn't budge, you know, and wouldn't compromise. And Groening said that, if you would just take the second most greedy position, you know, you would still get a lot of money and we'd have a show, but the compromise never was reached, you know. So, I mean, it makes sense that, like, devils, you know, we just can't compromise. I can't even conceive of such a thing, you know. So, even though the book conveys just how mad Satan is about this, because he is furious, you know, he doesn't want to give him the satisfaction, and he has to go along and cure his cancer, save his life from slashing his wrists, you know, and let him live, you know. I mean, I find all that very satisfying, and you know, it needs a certain amount of build up and a certain amount of, you know, space to play out to get to the resolution.
All right, so anything else about that, or let's talk about the final.
Well, I do want to say that you know, it ends with Constantine saying, you know, up yours, and him giving the middle finger with like a splash page on the last page of the book, you know, which on one level is like, you know, it fits the story real well and the character very well. You know, it's very, you know, it's kind of an essence of Constantine and what he would do, you know. It kind of, though, to me, anticipates a trend in comics I don't really like of like, let's be super transgressive and have these full-page panels that kind of mess with the reader, just like this kind of things that, like, Garth Ennis would do some, and Mark Millar would do a lot in things like, you know, Kick-Ass and Wanted and whatnot, you know. So it's like I like it here. It kind of starts a trend, I think, that I'm not that crazy about, you know. So, but anyway, yeah, but let's go to the epilogue, you know.
Yeah.
And I feel like that it's like an epilogue because the story's kind of over and not that much really happens in it. So while we were talking about doing this story for the podcast, I was like, do we even want to have the epilogue in it? And I would have been okay not including it, but it's like, yeah, we probably better include it because there are some things that happen that we need to, that are pursuant to the story.
Yeah. You indicated to me that it didn't really resonate that much with you. Why don't you talk about that?
Well, Constantine's like, he wakes up after a bender because he won. So he had like, he kind of went out and celebrated, then kind of had the enormity of what he'd done kind of catches up with him.
Yeah, and I like that.
There's an implication that if he had died and there had been this war, the collateral damage might have been incredible. So, you know, we don't really know if that meant like the earth would have ended or what, but he kind of implies that it would have been pretty bad, you know.
Well, and then the only real winner would have been heaven.
Yeah.
And that idea is as abhorrent to him as anything else.
Yeah.
You know, those pricks shaking his fist.
Well, I think he wouldn't mind that happening if more than the devil. I think he would have been okay with that, but he's certainly not a fan of heaven, you know. He runs into Kit and she's like comforting him and blah, 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 you know. And then he remembers Matt, who hadn't really talked about that much, and goes to see Matt in, you know, the cancer ward. And Matt, I think, you know, it's kind of a, you see why Constantine would like him. I think he's fine. You know, he doesn't knock me out, but he's got this very bleak, sardonic sense of humor. And he strikes me as being the kind of father Constantine wishes he'd had. And Constantine's dead father is kind of referred to several times in the book, you know.
Yeah.
And he kind of gets to say goodbye to Constantine to talk about the importance of friends. And then he has his, like, terminal attack and dies, you know, in kind of a grisly fashion. But it's not like Constantine literally forgot and got there and he was dead already. And there's no sense that the devil caused his death, so Constantine's actions and it came around and caught it. I mean, Matt would have died no matter what, I think. So him being beaten up about it works with, like, kind of the survivor guilt theme and grief for his friend, but it seemed to have, like, kind of the punch that I think the story calls for. So that's kind of why it doesn't really sell me, you know.
I see what you're saying. What I like about it, though, is, and the whole reason the character's there narratively, is he's a good reminder of the real life stakes that Constantine has messed with. And yeah, after the bender, you know, he's sitting there beating himself up for the fact that, you know, he could have caused this great holy war.
Yeah.
And
Because part of him would secretly love having caused a great holy war, yeah.
And also now that he's going to have to be more careful than ever because, you know, the three lords of hell are going to be trying to figure out any way they can to get to him. Mm-hmm. Like, they're not just going to say, okay, well, we'll just keep him alive forever.
We'll just wait till he dies of old age because he'll get him eventually. You know?
Yeah. As I said, it's a reminder of the real life stakes. This is what he's narrowly sidestepped. And I think that's important.
And that's why I like Matt throughout the book. You know,
The thought of being torn apart by the first in hell for an eternity is one thing, but the horror of Matt's final moments, you know, and blessedly, we don't see everything that he describes, all the things failing at once.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's blood and vomit in equal measure.
It's bad. Yeah.
Yeah. But, like, it's hard, again, to think of anything more horrifying than that. And I agree with you that it doesn't stick. Mm-hmm. The landing doesn't stick 100%. But, you know, I do like that he acknowledges it's more to him than, oh, yeah, I just pulled another one. Mm-hmm. You know, like, this shows exactly what he could have been in for.
Yeah.
I'm a little, when he's like, oh my God, Matt, I forgot all about Matt. And he's in a mad rush to the hospital and he's beating himself up. I was in two minds about it. Part of me is like, you've already said goodbye to him and he was cool with it. You know, it's not like he's going to be mad.
Yeah.
if he never sees you again before he dies. I mean, he might be sad a little bit, but you're like, it's running through his head, you know, he deserved to know, you selfish, you know, blank. And I'm like, really? That you beat cancer and he didn't?
Yeah, yeah,
it's he like, deserves to know that you won and he's losing?
Yeah, No one wants to hear that.
No. You know? And Matt seems like he's made peace with everything and he's just riding out his final days. And yeah, I'm sure he'd be happy for you on some
I want you to know that it worked out okay for me.
Yeah.
You know? Oh, I can die easy now. Thanks for that, John.
That's what I was waiting for. Now I can let myself go. Yeah, no, like, that part feels forced to me.
So, but I mean, it's, I like it, your use of the word survivor's guilt and sir in describing this. You know, it's very apt, you know, so it's like, I don't mind it ending, you know, with him being, you know, grieving his friend and all that. I'm not sure that this particular route to the ending is the most satisfying one.
Well, when I was talking about kind of the ideal Constantine, part of that is, you know, his friends suffer for what he does. He doesn't intend it, but it doesn't make it, you know, doesn't make it any easier for them because they're dead or in eternal torment or whatever. But also that it does gnaw at him. And this is kind of a play on that, you know, Matt's death is kind of substituting there, and that doesn't quite work, but still it shows that he's human and that he does think about what happens to other people, even if he decides, you know, damn the torpedoes, this is the only way to do it. And, you know, I'm sorry, like my best friend has to die or, you know, become a computer virus or whatever that one story was. I'm forgetting right now.
Yeah.
You need to know that he at least feels something.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And that he's not just the 100% jerk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. And having a quote from a Pogue song is very appropriate, you know, yeah. At the end.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, that is something that will come up again a lot more as this run goes mm-hmm. on. And the poetry of Brendan Behan is a motif that will come again and again, too. And I'm pretty sure that's why Brendan is named Brendan.
Of course, yeah.
But so I think we're at reckoning space.
Yeah, I did want to say we talked about, you know, the how prevalent Constantine had been, you know, in pop culture, you know, since this time. And I feel like, you know, Keanu Reeves played the role in the movie. Matt Ryan
yeah.
in, on the show, but
not the football player,
no.
And not Matthew Ryan, the singer-songwriter.
Yeah. But my favorite Constantine isn't really a performance of Constantine, but is the on Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the character of Spike, who was introduced as with his girlfriend Drusilla as kind of the Sid and Nancy of vampires,
right.
And as played by James Marsters, I believe is the actor. Mm-hmm. He's a blonde, punk rocky type, very sardonic. He's kind of more John Constantine than any other John Constantine we've seen, even
yeah.
though he's not really the same character.
Yeah, but absolutely.
Yeah, yes. I mean, I always kind of wondered if that was a coincidence and that just kind of dovetailed real well, or if it was intentional. You know, but I think he deserves a shout out in any kind of discussion of Constantine.
While we're talking about impact, you know, and influence on the culture, this just popped to mind. You don't watch or have never watched Supernatural, as far as I know.
I've seen the pilot.
Okay, yeah. Well, in the fourth season, a character is introduced. Oh, crap, and I'm blanking on his name. Castiel, an angel, and he first appears and he's got this long trench coat. And I read that the creator of the show had kind of that Constantine archetype in mind, although Castiel is not, you know, a hard-drinking, you know, British jerk.
Yeah.
But I don't know. That just popped into my head, so I thought I'd share it.
Well, one last thing I wanted to say before we got into the reckoning was just that we had a Doctor Strange episode a few months ago, and how I feel like Hellblazer or Constantine as a title works better than Doctor Strange titles that we've seen. I think because he's not as powerful and is more grounded, and Stephen Strange as a character is kind of more separate from humanity and kind of more aloof. So I think as a title, it seems to work better than a Doctor Strange title, just comparing the other famous magic user.
And I think the use of magic is better in Constantine, too. He's not... Part of what's hard to relate to Doctor Strange is, you know, and it's a problem we've talked about before, the kind of the conundrum of magic in these stories and how defined or not magic is. You know, we see him use a little kind of sleight of hand Jedi mind trick, as you mentioned, and everything else is pretty much... incantations and spells where there are candles and pentagrams and, you know, ancient Latin summonings or what have you. Whereas Doctor Strange just has, you know, like...
He's got Green Lantern powers.
He could just pull something out of his, you know, out of his book of spells. Mm. You know, it's like my handy dandy, you know, the spell of, you know, the pincers of power or whatever, you know. So that's another thing that grounds him is that the magic... You know it's there, but it's not omnipresent.
Yeah.
And it's very, very limited. So, okay, so that leads to the reckoning in which Kurt and I pass judgment on this story and whether it makes it into the hallowed halls of the comics canon. For that to occur, our vote must be unanimous, and there are a number of factors that we consider, Kurt,
such as we like to consider books whether or not they have... creative excellence, if they have lasting importance, if they have narrative urgency. What are the other things? If they have, I guess, influence in the greater culture?
Artistry was one. Context.
Yeah.
We bring up every now and then. Mm. And I have some notes, but why don't you go first?
Well, I thought about this carefully, like I always think about them, of course. And like I said, you could make a strong case that this is the best Constantine solo story. So that's almost like maybe it deserves it for that reason alone. But I feel like in Constantine solo stories, there might be something a little bit missing. And I was kind of reading this, kind of feeling that, and I've kind of felt that a lot. And I feel like he needs more of a foil character, like a sidekick or an equal or someone like that, to kind of someone he can play off of. So he's not just kind of narrating to the reader. And I was thinking about how, like in the Swamp Things, you know, he's a great foil.
Yeah.
They're a great foil to each other. And it's almost like maybe he works better as, you know, an antagonist to another character or some. Maybe he's not the ideal protagonist because, you know, he works better playing off someone who is the protagonist, yeah. You know. But that's kind of goes off in this whole other
Yeah, thing. I don't know how much of the Constantine series mm-hmm. you watched, but the supporting cast kind of sort of played that role at times, and mm-hmm. at times they were more like sidekicky, yeah. like Chaz. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I would say that in this book, I wasn't a huge fan of the art. The supporting characters in this, I think, are all kind of fine, but kind of ordinary and not super interesting. You know, they're kind of like nice people hanging around them, but none of them seem like equals to him, and it's hard to imagine any of them with their kind of inner life or what they'd be doing separate from him.
Yeah.
And the epilogue, I said, I wasn't that great. Okay.
Before you swing the hammer, yes or no?
Because I'm building up to something here.
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I wanted to talk a little bit about, all right, for example, the context, mm-hmm. Taking into account that this is before the Vertigo line mm-hmm. became Vertigo, yes. And it was still just this kind of walled off corner of the DC universe. Mm-hmm. So this is a mainstream comic. I'm sure you're not picking it up in the spinner rack
yeah.
at 7-Eleven, but just like Swamp Thing mm-hmm. and Animal Man and Sandman, mm-hmm. you know, all going on at the same time, and Doom Patrol.
Yeah.
There's some really weird stuff going on. Mm-hmm. And in this especially, to go into a comic book store in 1991 and this is not something that's being held behind the counter, mm-hmm. like the porn comics yeah. or whatever. Like, you know, you pick it up and you've got this guy coughing out his lung mm-hmm. and slitting his wrist, not once but twice.
Yeah.
You know, and these depictions of blood and guts, which are more suggested in some places yeah. than others. Like thinking about it at the time, you know, at the time, that's pretty heady stuff to yeah. just be picking up out of a 22-page, you know, sure. color pamphlet.
Well, why don't you say what your vote is?
Well, there's a couple other things. The writing I like, but it's one. It's a little showy in parts. You know, the dialogue and the internal monologues, and as it gets tighter mm-hmm. as he goes along, and the artwork. You know, we've discussed the coloring, mm-hmm. which I feel like it's a great idea, but ultimately it detracts the color. The art and the color together, the 1-2 punch is really murky and scratchy and kind of ill-defined. Will Simpson, by the way, according to Wikipedia, currently storyboard artist for Game of Thrones since 2011.
That's very interesting. Yeah.
Urgency, I think it's fine, mm-hmm. you know. Ennis does a good job of showing us mm-hmm. that, you know, Constantine is scared out of his wits mm-hmm. and this is thing he can't, you know, just easily beat. And in cultural impact, I think we've touched on yeah. all of that. So I just wanted to get all those out there.
Sure.
But
what are you doing? You do it because you jumped in. So it's your.
I think it's really close, but I think it doesn't quite get there.
Okay, for me, it gets there because okay. for me, it's like kind of the heart of the things, the premise and the setup and the payoff are both strong enough that for me, it does it, you know.
So. See, and I agree with that, but like I just get distracted mm-hmm. By some of the other things. And I kind of wanted you to go first because, yeah. you know, it's you might have been able to talk me out of it.
It's always nicer when the person who votes yes goes first, so yeah. there's still suspense, you know.
Yeah.
But no, I think we agree with all the points. It's yeah. just, I mean, I kind of am more the setup payoff works for me transcends the other things more for me than I think that it does for yeah. you.
Yeah. I don't know. It's a tough one for me because okay. like, I want to say I like it, but there's just something there are these little nagging things, these old thorns that keep me from getting all the way there.
I think we're going to have to close the gate of the comics canon at this point. So sorry, John Constantine, you don't get to ascend, you know, this time. You know, you're used to it, though. So.
And you may have other chances.
Yeah. I have a classic comic ad to...
Okay.
For now, I've never seen this before. I just saw it like a few hours ago and was like, I'm going to grab this. It's called America's Favorite Writing Fluid, Schaefer's Scrip. Scrip with a K.
S-K-R-I-P.
And, yeah. And it's like, the picture's like this, like kind of this inkwell sort of thing. And it says, makes any pen write better. Never clots or clogs. Always flows smoothly, evenly. There's a word missing here, but it says... Test proof, Scrip finest, safest writing fluid in the world.
Is the Hulk writing this?
Yeah. And there's like little boys like kind of excited about the jar and the fact that the kind of the top well bottle and that there's a magic circle cap, no freezing to bottle top, no sticky, messy rim. And there's a little boy running saying, permanent or washable around this like little line of ducklings for some reason. There's a mama duck with a skirt in front, 12 brilliant colors, Schaefer's Scrip, world's largest selling writing fluid.
That is really odd.
Yeah. And it's like, you kind of wonder, it's like, were they for copyright reasons, not allowed to use the word ink? Because I looked it up and there is like Scripps writing ink is like on Amazon. So you can call it ink now, but maybe you couldn't call it ink then.
That's really bizarre.
Yeah. I've never seen this before. Yeah. Yeah.
I'll put a link up to it in our show notes on comicscanon.com. Yeah,
well, why don't you keep the thing? So yeah,
okay. Yeah. All right, real quick, before we get into the spinner rack, our cannon fodder segment, mm-hmm. we do have a letter. Tracy writes in response to our Darth Vader episode, mm-hmm. I don't know much about the expanded universe, but Claudia Gray's novel Bloodline is an excellent exploration of Leia's psychology several years before The Force Awakens. I particularly enjoy how she reshaped the gold bikini moment into Hutt Slayer Leia, something she's renowned for across the universe. I was also surprised not to hear Eddie Izzard's Death Star Canteen mentioned among the comedy routines. I recommend checking it out on YouTube if you've never seen it. I had not heard of it.
It is very funny.
Okay.
Yeah. We're fans. Yeah.
Okay. So on to the spinner rack.
Yeah. One thing about Death Star Canteen, it would be hard to quote that on our podcast and retain the clean rating.
Gotcha. So the spinner rank is where we recommend books that may or may not have some sort of link to what we just discussed. Why don't you go first?
Yeah, I have a book that ties to it. And actually all things kind of loosely tie in, only one of which is a comic book. But I was going to recommend the storyline Swamp Thing American Gothic, which is from, I think, issues 37 to 50, or maybe it's 130. No, anyway, American Gothic was the title that introduced John Constantine as a character. And basically, there's this big threat that's going to, you know, possibly shake the foundations of the universe coming. And Constantine enlists, you know, Swamp Thing to help him out and kind of teaches Swamp Thing along the way that he's got all these powers as an elemental being that he was never aware of. So he's got, like, control over plants and can kind of enter plants and travel and stuff like that. And the first half is him kind of going across America and fighting, like, werewolves and zombies and serial killers and things like that. And this half is in the most recent book is titled The Curse, the trade paperback. And the second half is them kind of going, like, into kind of more mystical stuff and like their stuff in South America. There's a tie-in with Crisis on Infinite Earths, and there's this big kind of war in heaven and hell that has people like Doctor Strange and the Spectre and Etrigan the Demon, and it's all very big and exciting, you know. Maybe not obvious, you know, canon story that we would have on the podcast, but it's very fun and exciting, and it's almost exactly when I bought into the title and was following it. So, you know, it's like I remember getting those at the comic book shop, you know, very vividly. I was also going to mention, talking about Constantine as an exorcist, William Peter Blatty, the author of the book The Exorcist, died this week as of our recording, and he directed a film called The Exorcist 3, which is super underrated as a horror movie. It's not a classic, I would say, but it's very solid, and it has some of, like, the best jump scares I've ever seen. I remember seeing it in the theater very well, so... if you've never seen it or interested in kind of a scary supernatural occult movie, that's a good example of that. And I wanted to say that kind of in preparation for this, I listened to the Constantine episode of the podcast Alcohollywood, which is a very solid movie podcast where they talk about movies and they make mixed drinks that tie in thematically with the movie, and they have little drinking games to go with the movie. But the conversations are very solid and lighthearted and informative and funny. So, you know, it always kind of delivers the goods. And I'm someone who's listened to a lot of movie podcasts. So those are my recommendations for them.
Very good. All very good. And yeah, I second the American Gothic. Absolutely. I'm going to take a different take. I'm going to recommend, a different book with a hero with cancer. And that would be Jason Aaron's current take on The Mighty Thor.
Oh, yeah.
Not going to spoil anything. I will say that Marvel's propensity for renumbering books gets kind of confusing just starting off with a new number one, every so often. Of course, they had, the Secret Wars event that kind of jump-started their universe, and I think that probably necessitated it, maybe. But anyway, so the reading order I would recommend is Goddess of Thunder, the first collection, Who Holds the Hammer, and then Thunder in Her Veins.
I was going to recommend these books at some point, so.
There's no reason you can't recommend them again later. Also, briefly, speaking of the CW, they're debuting TV show Riverdale on January 26th, kind of a modern take on the Archie Comics characters, Archie, Jughead, Betty, Veronica, et cetera. So I want to recommend, and I might have done this before, Archie Volume 1 by Mark Waid and Fiona Staples, which is also kind of a modern reboot, reimagining of the Archie characters, if you will. And it's really solid. And the Archie books have done, as you mentioned to me, have done some pretty interesting things, tried some interesting things over the last decade or so. Like Afterlife with Archie.
Yeah, and I haven't read very much of them, but from what I understand, it's very inclusive, with gay characters and things like that that you wouldn't expect.
Yeah, it's pretty diverse. Yeah. So anyway, Archie Volume 1, I don't think it has anything to do with the show, which has a bit more of a murder mystery vibe and that kind of thing. Yeah. But it's a good solid read.
Yeah. I wanted to say, I mentioned that the Swamp Thing collection, the first half was in a trade paperback called The Curse, and the second half is in a trade paperback called A Murder of Crows. So should I tease our next week's, or rather our next episode?
Yes, let's do.
Yeah. Next time, we're going to talk about The Unbeatable Squirrel Girl, the first trade paperback, which has the news stories are 1 through 4, and I think Squirrel Power is the name of the title, partly because people are talking about Squirrel Girl a lot. Like, who is this Squirrel Girl that I keep hearing so much about? So
yeah,
it seemed like a fun thing to bring into the conversation.
It's something we've wanted to do for a while and, just haven't really been able to fit it into our schedule before now. Yeah. I anticipate that being a lot of fun.
Yeah. So, meanwhile, the Comics Canon can be found on the hoary hosts of podcasting, iTunes, SoundCloud, Google Play, and Stitcher, as well as our website, comicscanon.com.
And meanwhile, we want to hear from you. Give us your opinion on this episode, our recommendations. Do you think we're wrong? Anything. Just reach out to us. You can rate and review the show on iTunes, and that really does help a lot.
Tell us if you think we're wrong.
Yeah. you can email us at letters@comicscanon.com. You can post or comment on our Facebook page. Hit us up on Twitter @TheComicsCanon. And, of course, there's always just TheComicsCanon.com. We'll read your correspondence in a future episode. This podcast was recorded by Grayson Bergman. For the Comics Canon, I'm Kevin Morrow.
And I'm Kurt Holman. The Comics Canon will be continued next time with The Unbeatable Squirrel Girl.